G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 187th, Betty Has a Murder Mystery. That means we'll be going to the coroner's court this week. And in the US, of course, there's a case being heard in the Senate. Isn't it exciting? Now, my dear listener, I've always been an advocate to you that if you're in trouble, you get the lawyers in, let them do the talking for you. But if your lawyers are going to start saying things like, you don't have the jurisdiction to try this case, that's an indication that you might be in deep shit. But we'll all see how that plays out in the fullness of time. For us, it's episode the 187th. My name's Dick Newman. Let's get on with it. Back to the classics, just because I feel like it. That, of course, was Gustav Mahler, Adagiato from the Fifth Symphony. Adagiato, of course, meaning with pineapple on top. Well, my dear listener, it was all happening last week, was it not? Betty went off to London in total triumph to get the silly hat. The boys were onto it pretty much from the get-go about who will you marry, Betty, and Betty has told them all to take a chill pill on that. Same with religion. Betty is just asking people to calm the fuck down. Want to do it in Latin? Cool. Want to do it in English? Cool. You believe that bread without yeast can turn into the real baby Jesus? Well, we may all think you're crazy, but we'll respect your decision to believe in that stuff. We tried to get Betty to 1560, but had to catch up on Mary of Guise, and wasn't that going badly? Writing Protestants who really had absolutely nothing to write about. Just John Knox whipping up the mob. But we've all decided to hate Mary for being a girl and for being Catholic and for doing a darn good job. That's how it goes with mobs. We left it in November 1559 with Betty being nervous about all this Frenchy stuff going on, particularly in Scotland. Her cousin, Mary Queen of Scots and France, has pretty much declared herself Queen of England as well. Greedy little bugger. Mary of Guise in Scotland is unwell due to panic attacks and doesn't know it, but she would have been replaced by a young brother, except he got blown all the way back to France. But 1,000 French troops had managed to land with Betty's warships hot on their heels. Mary of Guise at this stage has no option other than to appeal to Aaron and James Stuart and even Margaret Douglas's man, the Earl of Lennox, to help out. Then it's the general call to arms. What say the Scotties? You think we want to fight for Mary, Queen of Scots, a foreign girlie who doesn't live here and her foreign mum you? No, thanks. Mary will see this as ominous. Yes, you're right, Mary, it is ominous. And move back into Edinburgh Castle and its nice thick walls. Just as well, James Stuart has been off to chat with Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, to make a Treaty of Berwick. English to team up with Scotties and belt the Frenchies out of Scotland. That would mean the end of Mary of Guise and the old alliance that has stood since 1295. 265 years of happy relationships between the Frenchies and the Scotties just gone. Mary is actually lucky that the keeper of Edinburgh Castle let her in. Yeah, he's okay with her. The situation looks pretty grim with English warships in the harbour and English troops crossing the border. In comes Lord Grey for the English to see if Mary wants to talk. Oh, yeah, Mary knows about talking. Mary knows that the English warships don't really have enough big guns to take the port of Leith, so she's thinking they want an honourable way just to go home again. What she doesn't know is that Lord Grey isn't thinking of trying it on with Leith at all. No, he's looking at Edinburgh Castle as an easier target. And what Lord Grey doesn't know is that Edinburgh Castle is not the easier target. But wait, here comes the voice of reason. Can you believe I just said that? The voice of reason. Even stranger, that voice of reason is Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk. He knows Mary has been spending up on Scotland and that Edinburgh Castle is no pushover. He also knows that Mary's brothers are pretty much running France and a direct attack on her might be a bit stupid. The job is to fuck over the Frenchy troops in Scotland and end the old alliance. Lord Grey will then send his envoys to Mary, knowing full well that she is charming and full of guile. The congregation haven't been game to send people to talk to her face-to-face because they think those guys would be turned by her womanly wiles. Either her womanly wiles or a girlish charm, something like that. The thing is, they're afraid of her speechifying. And the other thing is that by now, Mary is really very ill. Congestive heart failure causing her to be ill, lame, exhausted, and, yeah, she's swollen up, sad. Still, Mary will put on a big show, lovely silk marquee and top tucker, and she herself is still very charming. But she won't be too happy with the English proposal. All Frenchies, except you, of course, Mary, must go. Yeah, that's not going to work. Absolutely not going to work. The English have been having a bit of a go at Leif, but they're getting nowhere. And we're starting to think that there's no option left but to attack Mary herself. Mary is bottled up in Edinburgh Castle with her Frenchy top guy bottled up at Leith. Communication is pretty much impossible, so they'll be trying negotiations again. The congregation and English are insisting all Frenchies must go. Finally, though, they will send a delegation for a face-to-face with Mary, led by James Stewart. You're trying to turn us into a vassal state of France. All that great stuff you've done, like improving our defences, which are working very well, boosting agriculture and getting the economy on track, weren't for the benefit of the Scotty people. Oh, no, 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 you cunning old bag. You did all that to make Scotland great again for when the Frenchies take over. I'm serious here, my dear listener. These fuckers know and acknowledge that Mary has done an absolutely top job. She's fixed Scotland right up, and they've decided to hate her, so they've invented this bullshit about she's just doing it so the Frenchies can take over the entire country. Mary's got nothing, so she'll agree to dismantle the fortifications at Leith and send all but two garrisons of Frenchies home. In return, she will ask that the congregation abandon their treaty with the Poms, but that will be a no. Fortunately, nobody knows about Mary, Queen of Scots, signing away Scotland to the Frenchies, or Mary of Guise may not be alive still. We might think this was all easy-peasy on Betty, but in fact, Betty was rather worried. She's worried about would Phil take this opportunity to join teams with the Catholic Frenchies and give her the boot out of the big chair. Let's then have a nice early example of Betty being rather bright. Her envoy to Phil will be Anthony Brown, Viscount Montacute, zealous Catholic. Yeah, great idea. Send a Catholic to talk to the Catholic monarch. Anthony Brown will do so well that Phil will be onto the Pope saying, "Hey, Pope, I know those filthy Frenchies are trying to turn you against Betty, but don't do it. She's okay. She's cool." That's nice, but not even Anthony Brown can get Phil totally on side with Betty. Wrong religion. So Phil will send back his garter knight garter and say, "Hey, Betty, best thing I can do right now is to not be your enemy. If I were, then I'd have to come over there and give you a darn good kicking. But I certainly can't be your friend." Betty also has to send an ambassador to Ferdinand, Holy Sausage Emperor. Thomas Challoner is an elderly gentleman who has managed to be a statesman, a soldier, and an academic. Pretty unusual to get all three qualities in just one human. He's about 45, so that's elderly for the time. I wish I was 45 again, but I'm not. From a good Welsh family, did well at Cambridge, writes elegant poetry in Latin, done some time as an assistant to the German ambassador, where Super Sausage Chuck took a shine to him. Chuck even took him along to that stupid foreign war he had in Algiers, where Chuck got done. On the way home, Tom Challoner was shipwrecked off the Barbary coast, and in some weird event, managed to save himself from drowning by grabbing a cable from another ship with his teeth. I've got no idea why he used his teeth rather than his hands. It will save his life, but a number of his teeth will be gone. Tom also got a gig at the Battle of Pinkie, that total slaughter of the Scotties by Ted Seymour. That got Tom Challoner his knighthood. He will then give evidence against Bishop Bonner and Stephen Gardiner Boo Hiss during the reign of Teen King Ted. Mary will use him as an ambassador to the Frenchies despite his religion. Now, while he might have turned evidence against those bishops, he was pretty helpful to other Catholics, who were grateful to him, and now he's working for Betty. After a bit of time with the Emperor Ferdinand, Tom will be off to see Phil in Spain, but the climate did not agree with him, and there you go. Having popped into our story, he's off forevermore with the angels. Hi, Tom. No, hang on. Come back, because I haven't finished talking about it yet. All I did was give you a bio. And amongst his duties with Ferdinand, of course, will be the marriage talk. Our latest Tinder profile will be Charles, Archduke of Austria, and one of a gazillion of kiddies of Ferdinand. But even in 1559, when these talks were taking place, the gossip was out about Robert Dudley and our Queen Betty. So here's Tom Challoner writing to William Cecil. I assure you, sir, these folks are broad-mouthed where I spake of one too much in favour as they esteem. I think ye guess whom they named. If you do not, I will upon my next letters write further. And we all know it's Robert Dudley, with his dark eyes and flashing smile. We better check back in on our unwell Mary of Guise. She is struggling to eat and is constantly thirsty. Breathing is difficult and her mind is on the fritz. 27th of June and she will write her final letters to her guy in Leith and her brothers in France. Even now, it's still about business and politics. Not much about her personal troubles. My health has been quite good until 2 days ago when I had a relapse, and for 2 nights now I have had a return of the fever. I do not know what will happen. Mary would most likely know that she won't be getting better. She's still working, of course. Crazy. Who would want to be in charge of a fucking country? Word is out, and we all know Mary is dying. She will ask that her mate, the Bishop of Amiens, be allowed to visit. We'll say, oh, sure, lovey, except that total fucker, Aaron, who will veto it. Mary is now unable to lie down. Too much pressure on her lungs, which will prevent her from breathing. So in come the congregation to a seated Mary. She wants one final attempt to stop them giving away the old alliance and doing the treaty with England. Lord fucker Aaron will just boo-hoo-hoo. Oh, Mary, boo-hoo-hoo. Fucking hypocrite. Mary will go over it one more time for these dense dickheads. Look, I love Scotland. Everything I've done for Scotland was for Scotland's benefit, and just that. Nobody else, just Scotland. And one of the biggest benefits that Scotland's had is the old alliance with France. That doesn't mean I'm loyal to France, because I'm not. I'm loyal to Scotland and its people. And you guys need to be loyal to Mary, Queen of Scots, and her snotty husband, because if you aren't, you might find a big fat pommy bum on the missing stone from Scone. It's all too much for Mary, who herself will now boo-hoo-hoo, and there's big old soft-as-pudding Scotty nobles, and we're all boo-hoo-hooing, knowing that this will be Mary's last meeting. Mary will shake each of them by the hand and ask them all to forgive her for anything that has caused offence over the last 22 years, and at the same time to accept her forgiveness of their fuckery. Off they go, except for James Stewart and William Keith, who can stick around to witness a will, which will be done the following night after one last meeting with Lords Aaron and Son, fuckers-in-chief. Sadly, we have no record of what Mary said to the Aarons, but the Aarons were rather upset when they left. I just hope that was from Mary giving their sensitive boy bits a good hard squeeze and a bit of a twist. John Knox's deputy at St. Giles Church, a guy by the name of John Wilcock, will turn up and be rather nice to Mary, giving what spiritual comfort he could, while she lay there just drifting off to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream, for in that sleep of death what dreams may come. When we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity so long life. Yeah, hang on, it's not about Shakespeare and Hamlet, it's about Mary. And sadly for us, her story is ended.
Trouble all of the world, out sooner we'll be done. Trouble all of the world, I'm going home with God, no more. weeping and wailing. Jumbo, weeping and wailing.
Yeah, Mahalia Jackson there reminding us that the world is full of trouble, as if we really need reminding. We didn't really need reminding, did we? Mary Gies died after midnight on the 11th of June 1560 with her stepson James Stuart and the Earl of Argyle by her side. These two guys were great enemies, and their presence may tell us a lot about Mary's famous irresistible charm. For fans of the 1998 movie Elizabeth, Mary Gies was played by the rather tasty Fanny Ardant, who at the time was about 8 years older than Mary had been when she died. To make the movie more fun, they had a very lively and very much alive Mary playing seduction games with Francis Walsingham, then being murdered by Walsingham. Like a lot of historical fiction, you can find stories in history that Walsingham murdered Mary, but I wouldn't be trusting that. There was an autopsy carried out that confirmed it was actually dropsy that killed her. Nobody at the time thought it was anything other than natural causes. Even John Knox had written about her illness before she died. Everybody knew about it, including Mary herself. It will take over a month for the news to get to France, and then the news will be held back from Mary, Queen of Scots. Why would that be, you ask? Easy. We've got another highly strung human. Mary, Queen of Scots, had also grown up with this image of a perfect mother doing a perfect job, and it's all perfect. Which happens if your mother's not there in your life. You think she's perfect. Mary had no opportunity to find out what lots of us find out, that a mum wasn't perfect, so this image will make it even harder for the Queen of the Scotties to get over it. Sure enough, when Mary got the news and was off to her room for a few weeks of boo-hoo-hooing. When she came out, she sat for the artist Clouet, who will do a portrait of her, which is on the website under this week's episode, or on Facebook. Lady followers of Middle Ages fashion will note that Mary is wearing a white veil, white being the colour of mourning back in the day. Mary will send that portrait to Betty. Isn't that nice? But way nicer for Betty is that the old alliance will fall to bits. All that work from Mary of Guise was worthless. The Frenchy troops will go home. Scotland and England have made a treaty while upholding the peace with the Frenchies. English troops will also leave Scotland, and the country is in the hands of the Congregation Lords. Mary's body will just hang around for 9 months. Nobody wants to give her a decent funeral. Finally, it will be a secret midnight removal of the corpse, which will go on a ship to France, and she will be interred at the convent of Saint-Pierre in Riems and get a lovely life-size brass statue. Common smelly types will destroy that nice life-size brass statue in the French Revolution. Eventually, though, the Scotties will put up a memorial in Edinburgh Castle saying Mary of Lorraine, Queen of James V and mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Regent of Scotland from 1554 to 1560, died here 11th of June 1560. A lady of honourable conditions, of singular judgment, full of humanity, a great lover of justice, helpful to the poor. And that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is the end of the story of Mary of Guise. Mary, Queen of Scots's mum, is dead. Her mother-in-law, Catherine de' Medici, is just warming up. But I hear you cry, enough of this stuff. Where is Betty's murder mystery?
Right here, right down.
This little story starts with a problem. We're all worried about Betty's behaviour with Robert Dudley. So if she could just get married to someone, then we'd all know what was going on and could get back to planning the future. It's actually looking like Betty would really like to marry Robert Dudley, but sadly, he has that pesky wife. This leads me to a ghost story. Not much of a ghost story, to be fair. They never really are. 1810, and the derelict Cumnor Place will be pulled down. It had been a grand old mansion, but nobody loved it because it was haunted with a real genuine ghostie. No, ghosts are not real, my dear listener. Or if they are, they're fucking lazy, aren't they? Because every time you see a medium, people say, oh, the spirit says his name starts with a T. Anybody here lost somebody with a name starting with T? Yeah, the lazy spirits can never get their full name. Teresa, Terence, Teddy. That's because you pipe up and say, oh, it's my dear old Aunt Tiffany. And suddenly the medium has a heap of information he can play with. It's your auntie, it's a female, and so on. So, no, this house was not haunted by one Amy Robsart, wife of Robert Dudley, who had been found dead on the 8th of September 1560. Cumnall Place dated back to the 14th century and had been Abington Abbey before Tom Cromwell got hold of it. Amy moved into the place December 1559 when it was being leased to Robert Dudley's mate Sir Anthony Foster. Amy at the time was 27 and had been married to Robert Dudley for 10 years. Amy was a hottie and the only kiddie of the Sheriff of Norfolk and Suffolk. It seems to have been a love match that got interrupted when Robert, along with his dad and brothers, had to go to the Tower over the Lady Jane Grey stuff. Robert will work his way back into favour with Mary, but of course the family was broke, so he went soldiering over in France, with Amy staying in England. These two will not be making babies. 1558, and in comes Betty and Robert Dudley, her childhood friend, will be master of the horse and have that nice big bulge in his pants. It's his wallet, don't get too excited. He will become the favourite, and still his wife is at home. That wasn't too unusual. Betty discouraged all the courtiers from bringing their wives to court. She must be the centre of attention. Fair enough. Ladies, don't you think? Fair enough. Dudley looked after Amy with enough pocket money for to have 10 servants, and they had enough friends so that she could move around doing couch surfing. As early as April 1559, the gossip magazines were on about Betty and Robert. Here's the Spanish take on it. During the last few days, Lord Robert has come into so much favour that he does whatever he likes with affairs. It is even said that Her Majesty visits him in his chamber day and night. Stories are getting around that Dudley will divorce Amy and that he and Betty already have a secret love child somewhere. Now, it's hard to think that Amy would not have heard the gossip, and she would surely be noticing that Robert is spending less and less time with her. On the fateful morning, Amy will send all her servants to the fair in Abingdon. Amy had wanted to go too, because they did a nice line in fairy floss and deep-fried Mars bars. But old bag Mrs. Odingsells didn't want to go, nor did old fart Mrs. Owens. It seemed for some reason Amy felt obliged to stay home with the old battle axes. One of the household servants will come home from the fair, and there is dead Amy. The old chook said, oh, we just went to our rooms, we knew nothing about this. So why did Amy feel obliged to stay home with them if they're just going to spend time in their rooms? Now I'm asking you the question, my dear listener, I've got no idea. A messenger, bows by the name, will be off on his fastest horsey to tell Robert and Biddy the good news or the tragic events, one of the two. It's either good news or a tragic event. Either or. Dudley will write to his steward, Tom Blount, who had oddly enough headed towards Cumnor the day before. There came me to Bowes, by whom I do understand that my wife is dead, and as he saith, by a fall from a pair of stairs. Little other understanding can I have of him. The greatness and suddenness of the misfortune doth so perplex me. Use all devices and means you can possible for the learning of the truth, and make sure the coroner choose the discreetest and most substantial men for the jury to get to the bottom of the matter. 10th of September, 2 days after the death of Amy, and the coroner's jury is already sworn in and having a good old view of Amy's dead body at Cumnor. You might recall this is how we do it. The coroner has a jury who can go and poke or prod at the deceased. This mob will say, yeah, it looks like an accident. No presumption of anything evil here. The coroner's report will say that Amy left a bedroom to take the stairs and fell down by accident, which put two dints in her head. One of these was an inch deep and the other 2 inches deep. And you, my dear listener, might be just a tad more suspicious than our coroner. The impact of the fall, for good measure, had broken Amy's neck. Death was instant, and in the absence of any other marks on Amy's body, we're going for death by misadventure. Okay, detective listener, what have you worked out? A fall down the stairs might lead you to expect a bit of other bruising here or there. The two gashes on her head seem a bit deep. More information for you. The steps she fell down were stone, and there were 8 of them. That's not that many steps to fall down. Perhaps she just tripped on a dress and went down rather awkwardly. Perhaps there were other circumstances for us to think about. Was she well? Well, that depends on what letters you read, because the answer from these is yes and no. The no she wasn't well letter leads us to suspect that she might have had breast cancer, which can make your bones brittle. And any lady listeners out there, while you're having your shower tonight or tomorrow, do check your dear sweet girlish delights out for a lump. If that nasty shit comes your way, early treatment is the key for the best result. Take care. Don't be an Amy and end up at the bottom of 8 steps with 2 holes in your head and a broken neck. That's her physical health examined, as best we can, but of course we have no way to check on her mental health. The Dudley and Betty thing would have weighed on her, I'm guessing, and she may expect that she could have been killed anyway to pave the way for their wedded bliss. Or perhaps she became suicidal and threw herself down the stairs. Blount will question Amy's personal maid, who can tell us that Amy prayed to baby Jesus to deliver her from desperation. Then the maid will clam up, because that is going down the perhaps she suicided road, and suicide is about the worst thing you can actually do. We just don't talk about it. It'll send you straight to hell. Blount will report to Dudley of divers tales that have made him think her a strange woman of mind. Yeah, Blount's saying she might have been a bit crazy. Still, tossing yourself down a set of 8 steps is not a terribly reliable method of suicide, and Amy had just sent her frock to the tailor for alterations, not the actions of somebody who's about to suicide. And suicide was very rare back in the day. It's a mortal sin and all that. The verdict of the coroner also includes the words, "in so far as it is possible at present for them to agree." That tells us that our jurors were not unanimous on the "it was an accident" thing. It's a conundrum, my dear listener. Within days, the rumour mill will start up that it was murder, and if it was, then you know who the chief suspect will be. 10 months before Amy died, the Imperial Ambassador wrote, "I have been told by many persons that he is trying to do away with her by poison." Just days before the death, William Cecil told Betty he thought Dudley would destroy his wife. In Europe, people just assumed Dudley done it, with Mary Queen of Scots joking that Betty could now marry her horsekeeper, the horsekeeper having killed his wife. Personally, I don't have Dudley as the murderer of his missus for this reason. It will not help him one little bit, and I think he would have known that. She may have been murdered, but who knows? Perhaps she had some admirer who just couldn't take no for an answer. After all, she was supposedly a hot chick wife whose husband was never home and was neglecting her. Dudley will write to Blount, "Find out how this evil should light upon me, as I know there will be much gossip. I have no way to purge myself of the malicious talk that I know the wicked world will use." Now, his letters may not show him in his best light as a caring husband who's upset about his wife's death, but they do make it seem that he's shocked and looking for the truth. When he got the verdict of accidental death, he looked to set up a panel of Amy's half-brothers to go and search for further evidence. Now, that's been presented by some people as Dudley trying to interfere with the process to make him look innocent, and, yeah, okay, what's a guy to do? On the negative side, we have a letter from the foreman of the jury assuring Dudley that the verdict would be accidental. This guy, Richard Smith, had been a servant of Betty, which opens up the possibility of collusion. Then we've got a report of Betty telling Dudley that Amy was dead a few days before her death. Then, just to really up the tension, we've got Betty telling the court that Amy was dead by accident before the verdict came in. This is messy and mucky, is it not, my dear listener? Thing is that Dudley and Betty have a motive for wanting Amy dead, but any hint of scandal would mean the end to any marriage for them, and that's exactly what will happen. Their relationship will now blow hot and cold, and Betty will make Robert an earl in about 4 years. but he will end up marrying somebody else. Won't be for ages, but I'll tell you in advance. He will marry Lettice Knollys, who is a granddaughter of Mary Carey or Mary Boleyn, or Scarlett Johansson in the other Boleyn Girl movie, if you like. The suspicion of murder will hang around Dudley for life. In about 7 years, John Appleyard, a half-brother to Amy, will raise the allegation that Dudley done it. That will get Appleyard some time in the slammer until he can say Dudley didn't done it. In 24 years' time, the Catholics will publish a pamphlet that names one of Dudley's men, Sir Richard Verney, as the bloke who went to Cumnor Palace on Dudley's order to kill Amy. Sensational. But then they will go on to accuse Dudley of a number of other murders, and those accusations look pretty wild and crazy. My own suspicion will be that somebody murdered Amy with a view of making sure that Dudley didn't marry Betty. That somebody could have been Cecil, who had been out of favour with Betty due to her infatuation with Dudley. Killing Dudley himself would have been tricky and a bit obvious, but murdering his missus will surely mean that suspicion would be on the husband. It's the first place we always look when a woman is murdered. It was also a big risk, but if it's true, it paid off. Cecil will be back as the number one advisor, and Dudley will never marry Betty. Apart from Cecil, any number of ambassadors may have come up with the same idea. Best way to bust up the relationship and get Betty into thinking hard about marrying someone like our insane Dane. So many possibilities, and we shall never, ever, ever know. But what we do know is that Betty is back to being single on Facebook. Amy is buried at St. Mary the Virgin at Oxford, and Dudley spared no expense on a fancy funeral. But Amy will be back at the foot of the stairs on numerous occasions with any number of parsons failing to exorcise the ghost of Amy from Cumnor Palace.
There's something strange in your neighbourhood. Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
If there's something weird and it don't look good, who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
Yes, instead of parsons and magical stuff, they should have waited for science and Dr. Peter Venkman to get rid of Amy from the staircase. Look, maybe Amy just fell down the stairs. Humans can kill themselves in very odd ways. Have a look at DarwinAwards.com. The Darwin Awards salute the improvement of the human genome by honouring those who accidentally removed themselves from it in a spectacular manner. 9th of February 2020, Mount Gambier, South Australia. At midnight, the phone rang for Police Inspector Campbell Hill. What? Someone fell in a sinkhole? Struth, Bruce. Bloody hell. Better ring up the fire department. We'll need their rope rescue rig for this one. Now, the sinkhole is a big hole. That's what it is. It's a big hole with a waterfall, nice vegetation, and, of course, a nice, safe viewing platform. The viewing platform has a solid and sturdy rail. 20-year-old Bradley Streeter decided he would do a handstand on the sturdy rail at night in the dark. They did need the rope rescue rig to get his body out. And I'm off track, but I do like to peruse the Darwin Awards from time to time. You are possibly wondering if there are other English gentlemen showing signs of wishing to date and mate our dear Queen Betty. Shit, yeah. This chick is a stud magnet. It's the courtly love type wooing. Secret hopes and dearest wishes whispered in someone's ear, who you know will break that secrecy pact and be straight off to tell it to Betty. I don't care who you are or which gender or whatever your sexual preference is, hearing that people are hot for you and wanting to vote you in as sexiest queen 1560 is music on the eardrums, and Betty will not be discouraging this talk. While she won't discourage it, she is the queen and needs to be regal, so there won't be encouragement either. Or perhaps I should say direct encouragement. There will be broader type encouragement along the lines of, we want this stuff to get hotter. Yeah, put it out, I want to hear what these big studs would do with my nipples if they get the chance. That might not be a direct quote there. The sources suggest the wisest prince in England became a bit depraved and started acting like a heroine in a Frenchy romance story. Just a word on Prince. Betty will certainly be referred to and will refer to herself as Prince, meaning ruler without actually implying gender. There you go. Any mummy listeners out there, you can now tell your kiddies that you are prince of your domain, and they need to respect your title or face a flogging, or at the very least you may be inclined to nailing their ears to the floor. But you can be a merciful prince who knows where the ice cream section is at the local supermarket. Betty may be a girly type, but that will not slow down the jousts and tournaments. Great stuff, because our stud males can dress up in their fancy duds and get all manly, hitting each other to impress the queen. Hey, look, I am courageous, agile, and terribly well-dressed. I've had a bath, and can send a secret message to Betty pointing out my hopes, my fears, the state of my nearly broken heart that is just clinging on, hoping for anything. A small smile would do for now. And of course I'm devoted to you unto my very death. Oh, you hot, hot, totally hot queen. The old boys will be upset with Betty's influence on the tournament. For ages now, we've been competing as much as we can with no identity. We don't fly our colours or wear our devices on our shields. We're all the anonymous knight. That way, I can belt you, even if I'm a lowly knight and you're a powerful earl. Now we all want Betty to know exactly who we are, so our colours are out and proud. Now, I call a little bit of bullshit on this. I think it'd be difficult to be totally anonymous. An earl's armour would likely be just a little bit brighter or fancier than a lowly knight. Still, we old boys have to have something to make us cranky, and this has done it, and it's Betty's fault. Here's a quote. Our ancestors were as valiant and gallant as they have been since they left off their arms and used the colours and curtains of their mistress's bed instead of them. Yeah, mate, Betty gives zero fucks. She's loving it with the guys coming up with inventive mottos. Betty's motto right now is, I see and I am silent. Well, is that a play on the silent but deadly fart thing? I'm not sure. Or she likes Semper Edem, always the same. Here's a sample of the boys' stuff, and they go with a picture. So, this one, the picture is a sunset. Thy being ceases with its setting. The sun shining on a shrub. Forsake me and I perish. The sun reflecting rays. How wilt thou avert thy face? The planet Venus in a cloud. Mistress, save me. The full moon. What is heaven without thee? Yeah, I'm getting a little bit nauseous. One guy who we know for sure is mooning around our Betty is Henry Fitzalan, Earl of Arundel. Yeah, see, he's 48 and fat. Lucky not to have been killed by Mary. Betty doesn't trust him and doesn't like him, but he's a power player, so she has to be polite. It will turn out that she was right not to trust him, as we'll find out. Right now, though, he is competing with young Dudley, he of the dark flashing eyes, the brilliant smile, and the very hot dance moves. This is not actually fun. It's serious shit, as it would be, with two factions, of course. Something about we humans makes us want to pick a side to be on. If not for William Cecil, this could come to blood on the floor as we compete for Betty. In case you are thinking of joining one of these two gangs, it will be White Horse for you if you want to go to Team Dudley, and the Bear if you want to go to Team Arundel. Then you could say stuff like, I trust the White Horse will be in quiet, and so shall we be out of trouble. It is well known his blood as yet was never a taint, nor was he ever a man of war. Wherefore it is likely that we shall sit still, but if he should stomach it, he were able to make great power. Yeah, perhaps you can see that our language has changed into the language of Shakespeare. Lovely. Well, try this. I wish that his rival had been put to death with his father, or that some ruffian would have dispatched him by the way that he had gone, with some dag or gun. Okay, perhaps it was episode one. Way back then I told you that a dag was the shit around a sheep's bum, but in this time in England a dag is one of these newfangled pistols. A gun is more of a arquebus. But let's ditch Team Dudley and Team Arundel with their stupid fucking sayings and get back to Betty.
Ah!
right, so Magnificat, that means we're going to be talking about religion. Oh, dear. In fact, it was Monteverdi who's going to be born around about now, maybe in just a couple of years' time, but Giovanni Monteverdi, yeah, he wrote some pretty good stuff. How is Betty going on religion? She's a bit enigmatic, hard to understand it sometimes. I love this quote. It's a rhetorical question that Betty asked herself. Why can't the King of Spain allow his subjects to go to the devil in their own way? Excellent question. If you're so certain that this guy will be tortured for eternity in an imaginary fiery pit of hell, then why bother killing him in a very nasty way? It may be this type of attitude that has led modern historians to think that perhaps Betty was a bit of an atheist. Of course, you can't be a bit of an atheist, but the thing is, ever since the mad Welsh king, our English monarchs have been the head of the church. We don't want to think that any of those heads of church, selected by God with the proper holy oil massage, may have been an atheist. If Betty was an atheist, then generally, atheism is a grown-up thing. Young people should be allowed to believe in Thor, Harry Potter, baby Jesus and Santa. If we go back 10 years, Bishop John Hooper will say, now obviously before Mary burns his vocal cords out, "The daughter of the late king by Queen Anne is inflamed with the same zeal for the religion of Christ. That is, a zeal equal to that of her royal brother. She not only knows what the true religion is, but has acquired such proficiency in Greek and Latin that she is able to defend it." Yeah, that's what you might expect from a teenager who has an inquisitive mind. There is no particular record, so we should suspect that Betty did the traditional religious duties. Listening to the sermon go on and on and on, and all the other bits and pieces. If she didn't, then surely someone would have made a comment, and hey, I get that. She's the head of the church, so doing the church stuff is pretty mandatory, whether you believe it or not. Let's argue now that she was religious. Here's the case. It's Betty's very own prayer. "This God of my life and life of my soul, the King of all comfort, is my only refuge. For his sake, therefore, to whom thou hast given all power, and wilt deny no petition, hear my prayers. Turn thy face from my sins, O Lord, and thine eyes to thy handiwork. Create a clean heart, and renew a right spirit within me. Order my steps in thy word, that no wickedness have dominion over me. Make me obedient to thy will, and delight in thy law. Grant me grace to live godly, and to govern justly, so that living to please thee, and reigning to serve thee, I may even glorify thee, the Father of goodness and mercy." Yeah, that's a pretty good job if she was an atheist, isn't it? Betty's reputation will start to be transformed by writings and plays about her. She's going to become a bit of a superhero who bravely withstood the slings and arrows of misfortune hurled at her by wicked half-sister Bloody Mary. In these, there'll be plenty of religious events. Betty is having a snooze while under arrest at Woodstock, and here comes an angel to wake her. Then flip open the magic book that Betty has with her, and here's the text. "Whosoever putteth his trust in the Lord shall not be confounded. My Saviour thanks on thee, my hope I build. Thou lovest poor innocents and art their shield." In the public imagination, then, Betty was being persecuted and experiencing real magical events. Nobody will be pointing out that Betty smartly turned traitor on the Protestant magic show and did all the Latin stuff. Now, if you remember Bloody Mary, when she was in that boat under Teen King Ted, she kicked up a heck of a ruckus about saying, "I will do the Latin magic show, and nobody can stop me unless you kill me." So you can admire brave Mary, if you like, sticking up for a Catholic stuff, or you can go with the pragmatic Betty saying, "Yeah, okay, if I've got to do the Latin stuff right now, that's what I'll do right now." I'm with pragmatist Betty. Eventually we'll end up with guys writing about the cult of the Virgin Queen and making up prayers to put in Queen Betty's mouth. Stuff like this. "In the pureness of my virginity and holiness of mine innocence, be presented to the Lamb, my sovereign Lord and only God, my heavenly bridegroom and spiritual spouse, my everlasting King, dear Christ, and only sweet Saviour Jesus, there to see saints and to be a saint, and with all the holy patriarchies, judges, kings, and queens. Yea, with all the archangels, angels, saints, martyrs, confessors, virgins, and the whole company of thy celestial and blessed spirits, to reign with him over spiritual powers and principalities for ever, and to sing the sugared songs of my wedding day to my perpetual joy and thine eternal praise. Fuck, that is laying it on thick, is it not? This was written by a guy looking for royal favour. Yeah, he didn't get it. These guys are making Betty in their own image, or imagination, probably. We can consider that Betty may have been an atheist, or she may have been religious, but we can be sure that she's very smart. The people are loving the Protestant stuff being back, or perhaps they're loving it that the burnings have stopped. One way or the other, they're loving it. The House of Lords, though, is still conservative and into the Latin magic show. Betty needs to tread carefully. Betty needs to do a deal on what type of magic show we'll be having. Now, John Knox won't be saying anything marvellous about Betty. She might be doing the right magic show for him, but she is still a girlie, so she is unnatural, infirm, sinful, and whatever. Just not up to the job. Fuck you, John Knox. We're English, and we're going to continue to do the magic show the way we want to. In Germany, Luther's Reformation spread through the universities, then to the monks and nuns, then to the ordinary types. The princes in Germany took a stance either as persecutor or patron. Patrons just acted under instructions from churchy types and took no part in determining matters of faith. In Switzerland, a guy, Zwingli, was reforming about the same time as Luther. His reformation went straight to his fellow citizens, then the government ended up sanctioning the new religion, but had no role to play in doctrine or dogma or anything like it. Now, John Knox, top fucker, is doing the same in Scotland, and he will soon get an Act of Parliament that says, just like in Germany and Switzerland, churchy types will sort out how we do the magic stuff. The legislation is just there to make their work legal. England alone, then, has the government being, for all intents and purposes, the church. The government works out the Book of Common Prayer and then legislates it into practice. The whole Reformation was led by Henry, who said, "This is how we do things now, and you lot better come along with me." Henry gave himself total control and helped him score all that cash from the dissolution of the monasteries. As for the magic show, Henry tried to set a course nicely in the middle of Papist and Protestant. His death saw the Protestants want to go full-on Protestant, then Mary wanted to go full-on back Papist. Betty will try to be more like a dad in her policies, try to make both sides happy, which is tricky. Henry had also lucked out, or maybe is smart, in promoting Tom Cranmer to the Archie role. Cranmer was naturally very cautious and proceeded with the Reformation at a snail's pace. And that's the best way to do it. He failed to alarm people with anything radical. Just step by step, slow, uncertain, trying to satisfy a complete turd like Henry without upsetting anyone else, and very patient. Ideal guy. In other countries, we've had different churchy types squabbling over bits of theology and being messy. In England, the government decides what is what, and we have that nice conformity on the go. The government can look over what the various churchy types in Europe are coming up with and pick and choose what they like for the eclectic Christian religion that will become the Anglican Church. Our big breakthrough may be the Eucharist. Finally, we can give away the transparently bullshitty idea that bread without yeast turns into the real physical baby Jesus, in favour of the idea that perhaps when the magician does the magic show, some of the spirit of baby Jesus turns up. If we wanted to keep believing in total and complete bullshit, then the Enlightenment may never have happened. This is also, in some respects, a good time for the Reformation. Well, won't be so good in France, so I'm not sure why I'm even using the word good in churchy stuff, because those guys just love killing each other in nasty ways. The point I am, as usual, struggling to make is that those early reformers, guys like Martin Luther, who were very excited about making up their own theology, have gone to their heavenly reward. We've got the next wave of reformers coming through, guys like Martin Bucer. He was an academic who could make nice, intricate, magic statements that were well thought out and balanced. The intricate part will drive guys like Calvin crazy because they can't keep up with his ideas. He will do very well because he'll be very useful in negotiations, whether it's with the Lutheran princes or different factions of Protestantism. He is mild and gentle and very smart. Even so, there's the tricky subject of the magic trick and the justification by faith alone, and Bucer will look to moderate ideas so as to not offend Latins or Protestants. He ended up coming to England to work with Teen King Ted, but died a couple of years later. Then Vegpole dug him up to be burnt as a heretic. And to me, this is looking like the difference between the two religions. You've got guys like Bucer who are thinking, and guys like Vegpole who are digging up dead people to burn them. Other moderates will follow Bucer to England, then nick off with our best and brightest Protestants when Mary takes over. But our guys who nick off get to mingle with the next wave of reformers, and sure, you've got guys like John Calvin getting a hard-on when anyone mentions firewood, but there's lots of moderates where the English are. Still, it's magic stuff, so we get the odd hand grenade tossed in like John Knox. The end result for the English, though, will be the English nonconformity. Brilliant. We can tell anyone we like to get well and truly fucked, and they can believe the slug of House Red turns into a purple unicorn if they like. We're English, and we'll be doing English magic shows with an English god and an English baby Jesus. Overall, our English had basically gone down the Calvinist line. So when Betty got the top job, Calvin wrote a letter to her saying, "Hey, Betty, we need to sit down and have a good talk fest with plenty of PowerPoint presentations, corporate consultants, lobbyists, hookers and cocaine to come up with a nice uniform doctrine and figure out how the church government will function so we can finally have a true international Protestantism with mandatory conformity." Betty will reply, "Thanks, but no thanks. Now fuck off." And three cheers for Betty, because that is the exact right response she needed to give him. Fuck off, we'll do our own thing. A papal envoy will make the same joke all over Europe. "I have seen the head of the English church dancing." Yeah, boring old white men, not known for their great gags. He's kind of got a point, though. Young, happy princess who loves laughing and dancing and enjoying the attention of the boys doesn't sort of go hand in hand with a grave, terribly serious, solemn, sanctimonious governor of the Church of God. The legislation that makes Betty the head of the church in England says she can pick whichever religion she likes for the country. Should have gone for Jedi, Betty. She can fix the rank, officers, and pay for the officers of the church. She can do all this without parliament or a council or anyone at all, unless she chooses to appoint people herself. She is El Supremo of the church. Now, that was all thanks to Henry, who got that legislation passed in the first place. After Henry, Kitty King Ted didn't do a lot, and even when he got older, it was guys like Cranmer and Seymour and Dudley doing the reforming stuff. And the mob were okay with that. Mary thought it was a terrible idea and didn't take it up at first, but then she saw that, hey, if I can be head of the church, then I get to burn people alive. Woohoo! So she took up the title. Betty's first parliament was enthusiastic to give her the rights and honours of a sister, brother and dad before her. But Betty will want a bit of a name change from head of the church to governess of the church. That sounds like a downgrade, but don't be fooled. Same powers, just nice optics. In that first parliament, Betty will mandate that there will be no changes to existing churchy stuff until the next parliament, except we can read the creed and commandments in English if we like. This implies that the government will be taking back the management of religion from churchy types. Her early ban on preachifying was a very good idea. We've got returning reformers with who knows what new ideas, and those Catholics are also known to flap their gums with riots on their mind. Betty needs to get things calmed down. The Protestants will be pissed off when Betty decides that churchy types have to be celibate. She will cop a fair whack of kickback on that, but she's going to be firm. Here's a problem for you. While Henry had also been firm that churchy guys must be celibate, Teen King Ted said, nah, if they want to bang chicks, then they should bang chicks. Unnatural not to. He passed legislation saying all good to marry, so marry they did. And some had kiddies. And Biddy has just said those marriages were no good and those kiddies are now bastards. Now please remember, my dear listener, that in our modern times most people give zero fucks whether your mum and dad were legitimately married when his baby-making juice hit her baby-making oven, but back then it was a really big deal. Bastards, formerly legit kiddies of clergy, will need to go through the humiliation and expense of bringing in a private bill to Parliament. If we look at Betty's legislation on churchy stuff, we could conclude that she was as Protestant as Henry had been. That is, the legislation needs to suit the human with the silly hat. And on that note, once again, I feel just a bit exhausted talking about the bloody churchy stuff. Really, it does my head in. Stupid humans. Homo sapiens, my ass. We should be homo stultus or homo stupidus. Sadly, we will probably come back to this churchy bullshit next week. But next week, I'm going to kick off with Sir Francis Walsingham for a bit of fun. Jimmy Page, Tangerine from Led Zeppelin 3 to get us into some historical fiction, and we watched period drama Bridgerton. That's not historical fiction, is it? It's just some romance thing where the Duke of Hastings looks pretty good with his shirt off, but he's such a fucking dick. I don't know. I watched it with my sweetie. After an episode of Bridgerton, my sweetie would be off to her sweet slumbers, and I would watch an episode of Hernan, which is about Hernan Cortez going over to South America and killing people. Yeah, great stuff. It was an 8-episode series, and it's been renewed, I see, for another season. Not sure what they're going to do on the second season. I guess kill more Native Americans or convert them to the marvellous Christianity. Whichever the case, it's not going to work out well for the Indigenous people, I don't think. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And for some reason, the song Girl from Ipanema came into my head a couple of weeks ago, and it just keeps bouncing around in there. So I think we'll go out with the Girl from Ipanema, and hopefully that'll exorcise that demon from my brain. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
And tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. So sadly, how can he tell her he loves her? Yes, he would give his heart gladly, but each day when she walks to the sea, she looks straight ahead, not at him.